This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for July 16, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzzolo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. And later this half hour, we'll have cash grain analysis with Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op in Ludlow, Illinois. In agricultural news, key congressional leaders are calling on the president to put more focus on nutritional programs. We'll have this and other stories this half hour. And in the second part of the show, The Farming World, heard on many of these stations, we'll dip into the archives for an interview with NCGA President Darren Enan. It's all on the Friday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Let's take a look at how prices settled Friday afternoon in Kansas City and Chicago. In Kansas City, September wheat settled at $5.99, down 6¾. December at 6:15 and a half, down 7½. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade settled at 5.87¼, down 9. December 6.16, down 8½. September corn settled at 3.94¾, up 2¼. December 4.07¼, up 2. March 4.17¾, up 1¾. May 4.24¾, up 1½. July 4.30¼, up 1/2. August soybeans settled at 10.19½, up 1/2. September 9.98, down 3. November 9.85, down 3. January 9.92¼, down 2¾. March 9.93¼, down 3¼. May 9.92, down 2¾. August soybean meal settled at 307.80, up 20. August soybean oil settled at 38.31. And it was down 28. And those are today's settlements in Chicago and in Kansas City.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Here's meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights. He says that temperatures will be seasonably warm through the coming week to 10 days. Highs in the 80s and lower 90s will occur most often. Some briefly hotter weather is possible late next week when highs in the 90s may become more common for a brief 2- or 3-day period. Rain will be erratically distributed over the next week in lower Midwest locations. Most areas north of a line from Burlington, Iowa to Columbus, Ohio will see rain frequently during the coming week to maintain good soil moisture and crop development potentials. Rain totals of 1/2 to 1½ inches and local totals of 2 to 3 inches will occur north of this line by next Friday. And lower Midwest rainfall will range from 0.2 inches to 0.75 inches by this time next week.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon again, Dave.
It was a real taffy pull in the corn pit. First, it was down off the opening bell, and then it was up within a half hour or so, and then it was down again heading into the noon hour, and then it finished up.
Yeah, it was one of those days where you could kind of feel that the weather was pulling you, and like taffy, and the market was interesting because it seemed like it was fairly consistent in one respect, and that was a lot of spread trading was going on. And you know, usually, Dave, whenever you get to overbought or oversold conditions and you've got a lot of volatility and question marks in your mind as a trader, you tend to go into a spread to kind of try and offset your risk. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Today it looked like to me that maybe they were coming in and offsetting their long wheat and short corn spreads ahead of the weekend. We have run that thing straight up like the regular flat price to the point where we've gotten over $2 a bushel in lead month wheat over lead month corn. I think that's the best since July of last year. So we were over $2 coming in today. We were correcting that anywhere from 16 to 17 cents at some points in the trading session. That corrected around 11 cents today. You also saw the bean spread, the bull spread, come back around. You know, it was interesting. The trade seemed to want to go back off of that a little bit after the July expired this week, but here we are again at the end of the week, the November losing to the now lead month August, and that bull spread's back in fashion, even though some of the spot bean basis continued to widen around some parts of the country.
Why do you think the bull spread is working, given what you're seeing in the basis?
Well, I think it's simply put, the end users don't want to participate and give the full move of the futures market move this week. I was interested to see that this week we moved up about 31 cents, almost 32 cents in November beans, moved up about 12 cents in Dease corn. If you look at some areas of basis along the Illinois River for corn, or you look out at some processors in Iowa, they were widening their basis pretty much almost the exact same amount that the futures went up. I think at this point in time, because the weather market has not been confirmed, the high pressure ridge has not been set up, the cash market is fighting this futures rally, thinking it's mostly fund led at this stage. So that's what we have to look forward to the next week or 2 weeks, is if this thing's got real wheels to it and it's got real upside potential. You know, we were talking some pretty lofty numbers this morning when you and I spoke. You're going to have to get basis on your side, in my view.
So weather is set it up for the potential for some pretty volatile market moves Sunday night into Monday. Let's, for the moment, assume that the ridge is confirmed for next week over the heart of the Corn Belt. What might that imply?
Well, I think then you're set up to today's high of 408.5 in the Dease corn, and that might have been from the Globex trade. Yesterday's weekly high of 410. You take that type of a swing objective, and you're looking at moving back up into that 415, 427 level. There's a pretty good amount of congestion in that 10 or 12 cent range. So you're probably looking at the 420 area, roughly speaking, Dave, if you have that ridge confirmed. I think if you have the case of the beans, they probably have a lot more upside in terms of percentage terms next week if that ridge is confirmed, because it seemed like they didn't do as well on a weekly basis as the corn did and as the wheat did. I think the biggest thing that I looked at today after I got done with the day, I looked at everything that I look at, and I think it's going to be hard to rally next week without that weather on your side, because we hit the basis. But you've also got the markets and the outside markets turning against you technically and kind of fundamentally in terms of sentiment. You've got the July futures off the board. That's always kind of a critical time when July goes off the board. And we haven't had a break yet since the July, or a pullback in consolidation since the July expired. You've got the funds now in as longs. You know, they were working against us. Now they're on our side. How much more are they willing to put in at this point, though? And then you've kind of on the same mindset, you've got the technicals not nearly as supportive or as attractive to come in and buy what you think as is a dip. So if you add all that together and you're in the mindset like I am that wheat's a bit overdone here, we're at the top of a historical range in the last 5 years. If you take out 2008, we're at the top of that range right now. You've got quite a few things working against you, and you need that weather next week.
Seems to me also the clock is ticking, that because we're going to know a lot more fundamentally between now and the August crop production report, and I think that if it's going to get it done, it's going to get it done soon.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that goes with the European and Russian weather that's affecting the wheat markets right now as well. The Russians came out with some updated private forecasts. They did lower their total grain output on this update, but they kept their wheat output the same and said next 7 to 10 days we're going to be in the heart of wheat harvest. We'll see how it really looks then. So I couldn't agree more. Between the outside markets and this being the early part of the third quarter and having this weather bullishness, you know, and it's funny how 3 weeks ago the market was so, so bearish, and now we're getting to the point where we're getting to a fever pitch talking about $11, $12, $13 beans on the radio. So you see a major shift in psychology, and we got to be very, very careful of that.
Did we really talk about $8 beans 3 weeks ago? How amazing is it?
It is, and you know, not even that. If you look at the June 29th low, and you think about and go back and look at some of the market reports that were being published about how bad the market was going to be and how the wheat was going to carry us on lower. I mean, it was the kiss of death. Now we're hearing this type of market reports that are saying that we're going to be back to global stocks-to-use ratios that are going to be under 2006-2007, and that we don't have enough demand, or we don't have enough supply to meet demand, and we're going to have to constrain ethanol again. We're right back to that level again in terms of trade psychology.
What's the S&P telling you today?
It's a high in the S&P, Dave. It looks really, really toppy. It looks really tough. I think you've got a swing objective heading towards that 1035 to 1040 initial support level. You've seen the dollar come back around and firm up, and you're only about three or four ticks from a contract high in the September bond futures. That could denote that we're going to go back into a safe haven mindset next week if these outside markets get any weaker. The Citigroup earnings and the profits falling 37% in the second quarter, I think, really shocked the market, and unfortunately we've got kind of a bank-led decline here today, which I never like to see.
So what's the producer to do? Say they looked at this all day long and couldn't make up their mind, and the market closed on them, and then they said, gosh darn it, I need to do something. Is there something they should do Sunday?
Yeah, I think at this point, if you see the rain come in, even in the central and eastern Corn Belt, and there's a lot of bigger dry areas of Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio that are showing up. Clients and subscribers have been telling me that all week. But if you can alleviate that problem on Sunday, I think it'd be wise for people and producers in those areas to go ahead and get a little bit more done in 2010 crop. I actually wanted to start 10 to 15% sales in the 2011 crop for corn, beans, and wheat this week as well, and we did get some triggers hit. I think this is a textbook year of selling and defending, Dave. That's the bottom line. And don't oversell the cash bushels, because this is one of those years where if you do have a localized problem, it could mean a lot to the trade overall. So don't overbook yourself on cash sales. You know, use a diversification type way to sell.
Should I be doing anything with re-ownership at this point?
I think in beans you really need to be at this point, Dave, because if you do cut the carryover in half from 360 to 160, you know, you're talking about a situation that you're looking at like 07 or early 08, where if the meal continues to play ball with you, we're maybe still a dollar underneath where we ultimately could go. And the neat thing about beans is, because of this early mark that we're looking at as far as the trade jumping early on, you don't have to push a lot of time decay into these option strategies that you use to defend. And so you could even get by with maybe splitting up some of your re-ownership into September options that only have about a month of life left, do another balance on November. And then if you're worried about the market still going higher after, you know, Christmas, or into Christmas, then you could do the last third or something like that into January. But that kind of splits up your risk. And as those options go up in value with that theoretical move up in futures, you just lift out of those contracts.
And the costs for these options looks to be pretty reasonable right now.
Not only that, but the implied volatility has stayed very, very low. That's the other thing that I really like to see here, kind of confirm or support the idea that this upside potential is for real, because implied volatility right now on an at-the-money bean call, like a 980, it's showing up less than 26% for both a call and a put. Dave, I've seen years where those things get into 60, 70% implied volatility. It doesn't happen very often, but it's not hard to get into the mid-40s to mid-50s. So I'd say we've got half the implied volatility that we potentially could have if this market really wants to go.
Thanks, Mike. We'll talk to you later this afternoon on Commodity Week.
Appreciate it, Dave, and thanks for the time. I'll see you later.
Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics, and he is in Lafayette, Indiana.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In agricultural news, Senate Agriculture Committee Chairman Blanche Lincoln and House Education and Labor Committee Chairman George Miller are calling on President Barack Obama to make child nutrition reauthorization a top legislative priority before the current program expires on September 30th. In a letter to the president, the two chairmen note that a majority of members in both chambers have signed letters to leadership declaring their support for the legislation. The president has called for a $10 billion increase over 10 years to help expand the child nutrition programs. The Senate Agriculture Committee has approved a child nutrition bill with a proposed $4 billion increase over 10 years. The House Education and Labor Committee is proposing an $8 billion increase over 10 years, although Miller says he is still searching for budgetary offsets to cover the higher spending. Ethanol industry advocate Growth Energy yesterday called for the gradual phasing out of the 45-cent ethanol blender's tax credit, while redirecting a portion of what amounts to billions of dollars toward building ethanol infrastructure, such as blender pumps, flexible fuel vehicles, and dedicated pipelines for ethanol. Growth Energy CEO Tom Bias says that doing so would allow the industry to compete on its own in the open market. A bill approved by the House Education and Labor Committee yesterday would allow the Agriculture Department to create new standards for all foods in schools, including vending machine items. The legislation would spend about $8 billion more over 10 years on nutrition programs. A Senate committee approved similar legislation earlier this year, but the full chamber has not yet considered the bill. New standards would not remove foods like pizza or hamburgers from schools completely, but would make them healthier. Vending machines could be stocked with less candy and fewer high-calorie sodas. House Agriculture Committee Chairman Colin Peterson wants Congress to finish the Farm Bill by late 2011 or early 2012 to make sure the Obama administration implements the bill. Peterson also says he believes that the next Farm Bill may have less money to spend than the current one. Peterson says he believes that the deficit commission jointly established by Congress and the White House may have some traction, which might mean writing a farm bill while Congress tries to reconcile the budget. Industry specialists say Brazilian corn exports are set to surge in the second half of this year with the help of government freight subsidies, but total exports for 2010 are still likely to fall short of last year. Brazilian corn exports of 2 million metric tons over the first half of the year were down 40% year-on-year, but are expected to pick up and reach 7 million metric tons by year's end. China's Commerce Ministry today says the PRC is likely to import 5.8 million tons of soy in July, the second largest monthly import level after June's record 6.2 million tons. Buyers also reported 196,520 tons of soy oil to arrive this month. No Argentina soy oil will be loaded in the month. The European Union could lift a ban on the use of animal protein in pig and poultry feed imposed in 2001 as part of efforts to fight mad cow disease under plans published today by the bloc's executive. Under the European Commission's plans, pig meal could be in the future fed to chickens and vice versa, but a ban on intra-species recycling, such as feeding pig meal to pigs, would remain. A ban on the use of animal protein in feed for cattle and other ruminants, such as sheep and goats, would also stay. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op in Ludlow, Illinois, is away. So joining us now with Cash Grain Analysis is Jenny Springer of the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. Good afternoon, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Dave.
One of the questions that has been rattling around in my head is, why has basis dropped off and gotten wider? Even though, I understand that futures are stronger, but farmers really haven't sold into it that much. So I'm kind of curious your thoughts on that.
I guess it's just an off-the-cuff answer. Especially the processors, if the board is up, they're not having to pay up in the basis to get corn to move. I think with the the rally that we've seen here in the cash and the futures market, the processors are able to get guys to move corn a little bit quicker, even if it's at a lower basis. I know our basis here at the elevator has stayed steady to improved here over the last month or so. So we're really not seeing, the basis fall off here.
Well, that makes sense for corn, but I'm more curious about the beans.
I think it's along the same lines. I mean, we've seen quite an appreciation in the market value for beans. And the other thing is, too, we're getting to the summer months where processors are taking their shutdowns for bean processing. So they're not needing to be as full right now, looking at a 2 to 3 week shutdown for their summer repairs and maintenance.
At your elevator, how sold up are corn and soybean producers?
On old crop or new crop?
On new crop, I'm curious about.
We've got guys all across the board. I would say a good majority of our guys are in that 40 to 60% sold range. It's been our advice to thus far is to get to that 50% sold level, and then I think we've got a little bit more time, to get that last half of the crop priced. We have had a lot of new crop sales with this rally.
It's a puzzlement how to price because of the variability of the corn given the weather.
Well, and we've been telling guys, you are in your field. You see what kind of crop you have. You have to price based upon that in the area that you're in. Because I know the rains have been extremely widespread. I know north and northwest of the elevator here, guys have gotten a lot less rain than even to the east and then to the southeast.
And it has been quite variable, and it looks to be continuing so. And do you think that there is a shot for basis, and we got about 30 seconds left before you have to give us your prices,
mm-hmm.
for basis to rally between now and, say, the August crop production report?
I don't really see much of a change between now and August. I think we see more of a opportunity for that towards the end of August to try and get some new crop corn out of the fields and into the flow of everything.
Very quickly, your prices.
Cash corn today, $3.83. Fall corn, $3.77. Cash beans, $10.30. New beans, $9.65. And cash wheat, $5.62.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks.
That's Jenny Springer, and she is with the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. In 2 minutes, I'll be back with a look at agricultural weather. It's National Corn Fritters Day. A fritter is any kind of food coated in batter and deep fried. The origins of the corn fritter are murky at best. The Boston Cooking School Cookbook of 1918 had a recipe for corn fritters. On this day in agricultural history, in 1704, John Kay was born. An English machinist and engineer, he invented the flying shuttle power loom, which was an important step toward automatic weaving. But at first, his invention was not appreciated by weavers who thought it would steal their jobs. Ultimately, he was forced to flee from England to France. In 1907, Orville Redenbacher was born. An American agronomist, Redenbacher founded the gourmet popcorn business. In the 1940s, he and a friend, Charles Bowman, experimented with corn hybrids from Purdue University, the forerunner, decades later, of gourmet popcorn. By the way, Redenbacher once appeared on To Tell the Truth, where he stumped the panel. And in 2004, the city manager of Key West, Florida, fired its official chicken catcher. Armando Pera was hired to catch and relocate some of the more than 2,000 wild chickens that roam this small city island. But Key West City Fathers did not feel he would meet his contract quota to relocate 1,000 chickens by September. And so Pera was given the axe. And that's this day in agricultural history. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us for our look at the agricultural weather is meteorologist Josh Darr of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago. Good afternoon, Josh.
Good afternoon, sir. How are you today?
I am doing well. Come Sunday night, when we have that weather run, I expect that the markets could be quite volatile in the overnight session. And the reason I say that is because we keep seeming to go back and forth about this strong ridge of high pressure.
Yes, it's certainly going to be the feature that will drive the market the next couple weeks. And it's in our view, will be a very warm period of time here across the Midwest. And if talking more specifics about that ridge of high pressure and how we expect it to evolve here, it's a feature that is in the southeastern U.S. here through the weekend, but then as we go through next week, we see that becoming more of a dominant feature across the central portions of the U.S. And when do we really start to see temperatures up above 95 that may start to impact things? Well, in the southwestern portions of the belt, eastern Nebraska, northwestern Missouri, et cetera, that's going to be generally Tuesday will be the first day you start to see those temperatures creep up to 95 and above. And then we expect, as you get into the middle and latter portions of next week, that those 95-plus readings, high dew points, which keep your nighttime mins very high, that'll be a very dominant feature Wednesday, Thursday, and even into Friday across a good portion of the Midwest. So we think that's certainly going to be a feature which could impact the markets by Sunday night.
The driest regions, maybe what, eastern Kansas, southern Illinois, western Kentucky, that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. The southwestern quadrant of the belt will be the hottest and the driest. And really, you know, in our view, you look at now and go out 5 days, then go out 6 to 10 days and 11 to 15 days, and we do not see very major precip for the belt, meaningful amounts above 4/10 of an inch. You go 20-25% coverage for each of those five-day blocks, and that's it. So not only do you have the heat on, but you have precip that's well below normal, and that's certainly going to be an impact here as we get into the latter portion of July and, you know, potentially could be an issue as we step into August.
But down in the Delta, the driest parts there, they should get some rain then.
Yes, that's right. Thunderstorm activity over the weekend looks to persist across the Delta. And in the northern part of the Delta did get some relief from a precip standpoint here late last week and early this week. It looks like you do fire up some thunderstorms this weekend, and then thereafter, man, still a drier than normal pattern for the Delta, too. Ridges right overhead.
And we've been talking primarily corn and soybeans at the moment, but for the U.S. hard red winter wheat growing area, the primary growing area, is no relief there either, it looks like.
Yeah, well, with that ridge of pressure, high pressure sliding to the west next week and being more of a dominant feature across the central portions of the country, certainly harvest activity should continue to ramp up there for areas that aren't done yet. And but it's a net drying pattern tune for the plains. It's a little early to start to think about planting yet, but it will definitely be a dry, hot, southerly flow out over the plains the early to middle portion next week.
Thanks, Josh.
All right, thanks, Dave.
Josh Darr of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago. And you've been listening to the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you and online at willag.org, stay tuned for The Farming World. This is Dave Dickey.
The This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Darren Enan. He is the president of the National Corn Growers Association, also known as the NCGA, and he's from Hurley, South Dakota. Mr. Enan and his family operate a farm growing irrigated and dryland corn and soybeans. They also raise stock cows and manage a contract hog feeding operation. He's been involved in the corn growers' issues at local, state, and national levels, participating in NCGA's Leadership Academy, the South Dakota Corn Growers Association, NCGA's Biotechnology Working Group and Production and Stewardship Action Team. Thank you very much for taking so much time with us today, Mr. Enan. We do appreciate you doing that.
You're very welcome.
What has been your issue of passion with the corn growers? Which one do you really get excited about?
Well, you know, I get excited about the ethanol industry. It's a great growth market for corn and for, you know, our corn products. I'm fortunate enough to be chairman of a board of an ethanol plant, so I've got a lot of experience and background and passion for that. But really, you know, it comes back to all of our end users, you know, livestock and exports. I mean, you have to be passionate about anybody that's going to use our corn. And however we can help them use more of the corn that we produce, that's really the goal. And so, you know, ethanol is, you know, kind of my first thing, but, you know, I've been involved in all facets of corn usage and corn growing. And so that's just kind of how I came to be part of the National Corn Growers Association, is just a passion for promoting our own product. And that's really the key, is how can we promote our product so that not only how we grow it and how we raise it, but also how we get people to use it, and how we get our end users to use all the corn that we grow.
I'd like to get just a bit of a sense about you in a broader perspective. What kinds of other organizations have you been involved in there in South Dakota, from the local school district, if you happen to serve on the board? I suspect you might be involved there, or other, whether you're involved with the Beef Association in South Dakota or the hog producers, or what kinds of organizations?
Well, you know, the first organization I really got involved with was corn, and so that is kind of where my passion was. It's where I spent a lot of my time. Locally, I was on a city development board that looked at trying to bring businesses and industries to a small town. You know, of course, I'm president of an ethanol plant board, so I've been the president on that since 2001, so that's been a long period of time where I've, you know, had the opportunity to interact with local leaders through our ethanol plant and other board members. Still a member of the South Dakota Corn Utilization Council, active with that yet. And then, I'm trying to think of what else I've been involved with. Just, you know, wherever, I guess if somebody asked me to help out someplace, that's what I've done locally. But, you know, a lot of my efforts have been, especially the last few years, have been nationally. But it's still nationally, all ties back to your state organization and working together with state corn grower organizations and the National Corn Grower Association for the betterment of all corn growers.
And who's the ethanol plant owned by? Is it a farmer-owned organization? And what's the name of that plant?
It is a farmer-owned plant, but it is a POET plant. So we work with the POET folks, but it is farmer-owned.
And the name of the plant is?
POET Chancellor.
POET Chancellor. And is it in Hurley, or is Chancellor the little town it's in?
Chancellor is a little town. Hurley's just in, my address is right between Hurley and Chancellor, so it's about 7 miles from the ethanol plant, so it's close. Our farm is actually located, for those of you from Illinois and Indiana, about 25 miles southwest of Sioux Falls, so I'm in the very southeastern part of the state.
Okay, well, thank you very much for all of that. Now, I want to ask you a quick question, because you are not only a corn grower, but you also raise livestock, you know, stock cows. Do you still have them? And do you still have the hogs?
Yes.
And how do you, you probably get asked this a lot, in the food versus fuel debate and feed versus fuel debate, how do you reconcile those two debates with what you actually do on the farm? Because you're doing all those sorts of things.
Well, you know, it's a tricky explanation sometimes. I guess it comes back to, you know, as a corn grower, the livestock industry is important to us. The feed industry is important to us. The ethanol industry is important to us. And so, you know, what I try to stress is, you know, we can have our differences, whether, you know, it's, you know, with the other industries, whether it's food versus fuel or feed versus fuel issues, we can have our differences, but let's keep those differences amongst ourselves. Let's talk through them. You know, there's a lot of other areas we can work together. We do a lot of work with the livestock groups on environmental issues. We do a lot of work with them, helping them with the Humane Society of the United States type issues. And so we have a great working relationship with the livestock industry. We might disagree on the food versus fuel, but let's get past that. Let's concentrate and work on other areas that we know we can work. And the second thing is that we have provided the corn that everybody has needed. We've always grown enough corn to meet all of our end users' demands. And that's the key thing to remember, is that it's not food versus fuel or feed versus fuel. We've got corn for everybody. And again, we got a record carryout this year again. There's a lot of bushels around. And I guess that has put a lot of that myth and a lot of that tension aside, is because we are producing enough for everyone.
What's top of mind for NCGA as far as the ethanol issues and policies that should be debated at this point?
Well, you know, a couple areas right now, we're definitely lobbying for higher blends for E15. We think that's important as a corn grower, because we are growing more corn. We need to use more corn, but it's important for our country. Why not use homegrown fuel? Let's use products that we can make right in this country. It creates jobs. It's good for real economic development, and so that's a big issue. And the other issue that, you know, some legislation was just introduced here a week ago, is extending the tax incentives for blenders, the ethanol companies and the blenders that blend ethanol. We want to extend those tax credits, and so there's a bill that's been introduced in the Congress to do that. And so that is that's an action center where we want our members to call their congressional folks to sign on and support that bill, because, again, renewable energies is a new industry, but why not use those dollars in this country instead of overseas buying foreign oil?
At what point do you think the industry will be able to function without the aid of the government?
Well, you know, the counterpoint that I would say to that is when can the oil industry function without aid from the government, because they still get tax incentives, they still get tax breaks. We spend a lot of money military-wise protecting those oil sources. And so, you know, by us using the tax credits, you know, that just helps us get on a level playing field with the oil industry. And, you know, the oil industry is our competitors, and so this blender's credit, for example, entices them to use our ethanol product, because we are competitors. And so, you know, we just want a level playing field. And, you know, the oil industry's been around for over 100 years now, and they've had some type of financial assistance from the very beginning. And so that's something that not all people realize.
What are the other issues that are top of mind for you? Are you working with conservation or biotechnology, insect risk, resistance management? What's next on the list?
Well, you know, of course, we're always working on insect-resistant management. We want to make sure that, and try to educate growers so that they are planting the refuge, making sure that we can keep these biotechnology events available to us on our farms, because if we don't comply and if growers don't follow the rules, we do have the risk of losing these products. I mean, we are using a regulated product by the EPA, and they watch that very closely. As far as environmentalists, we belong to a group called Field to Market, that's put out some great information here in the last year or so on sustainability, and it's got some good background information on how we've improved how we farm and how we raise crops in the last 20 years. You know, we're using less water, we're using less pesticides, we're saving oil on our soil erosion, and so there's just a lot of nice benchmark things that environmentally that we are involved with. And this Field to Market involves, you know, McDonald's and Coca-Cola. It's not just ag groups. And so it's a nice broad spectrum of people that are from the food industry back all the way to the farm to show that we are doing more with less and doing a good job protecting our environment.
Mr. Enan, can you tell me more about the kinds of things that NCGA is involved in? And I'm thinking maybe I'd like to talk a bit about transportation issues. You're looking for reliable and cost-effective transportation for reaching marketplaces. Are we mostly concerned with rail transportation, river transportation, all of the above?
Well, it's definitely all of the above. Of course, you know, one thing that I failed to mention earlier that I really need to stress is that we are working very hard on getting the locks and dams upgraded on the Illinois, Ohio, Mississippi rivers. We think that's important to not only move our products downstream, but to get products that we use on our farms and that our urban friends use that come up the river. And so, you know, we're working very hard to get appropriations. Of course, the legislation has been passed to fix and rebuild some of these aging locks. Now we just have to find the money to do it. So river transportation is very important. We also are working on rail transportation, some of that kind of legislation that protects us as shippers. The railroads are kind of, it's a monopoly, and so we're just working on some legislation that protects us to make sure that we get a fair deal when we ship our products. So transportation is very important. And, you know, one thing that we probably should talk about is communications, just like this interview here right now, great opportunity for us to reach not only our farm friends in the countryside, but also to reach our urban friends so they understand agriculture, they understand how we do our businesses, and the National Corn Growers has done a great job, along with our states, working together, putting out great pieces of media. We're working on videos that are on YouTube. Just communication is the key, and just informing people and really how we run our operations and how we are doing a good job here on the farm.
Just a few minutes left. Let's talk about transportation, the locks and dams. Some money has been put aside for that, actually raised by a fee on fuel for the boats that run the barges up and down the rivers, and that's been in place for a very long time. But you've been not successful in actually making Congress, or getting Congress, I suppose, to fund the other half of that program, although there is legislation that was passed. They just haven't found the money. Why didn't it come out of the stimulus packages?
Well, the way the stimulus bill was written, it said it had to be shovel-ready. And, you know, this wasn't quite shovel-ready, unfortunately. I mean, even though we know it has to be done, it would be a tremendous opportunity to create jobs, create economic development along the river by maintaining and fixing and rebuilding these locks, but it didn't qualify under the stimulus, unfortunately. I mean, what better way to use tax dollars if you're going to be spending money than something that would actually create jobs? And so that was frustrating, but again, you know, like you mentioned, the industry, the fuel tax pays for some of the construction. And of course, that comes right out of me as a corn shipper. For example, if my corn gets to the river and goes down the river, I'll pay a little bit higher. I'll take less for my corn to help on the fuel tax to upgrade the locks and dams. I mean, corn growers are very committed to working through this issue of getting the river transportation fixed. And, you know, we just challenge not only the government, but other users on the river to do the same thing, because it is a critical, important link in our transportation system. And if we don't keep it up to date and modern, you know, the rest of the world is definitely building, and they will pass us up.
Darren Enan is the president of the National Corn Growers Association. That's the NCGA. He joins us from Hurley, South Dakota. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You've been listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the World Bank says the 10 Eastern European nations that have joined the EU since 2004 are seeing economic growth again for the first time since the start of the global financial crisis in 2008. It says the countries recovered from a 2.1% slump in output in the last quarter of 2009 to an 0.8% rise in the first quarter of 2010. But in a summary of a study which will be published next week, the World Bank calls the recovery weak. It said today that countries will not see pre-crisis growth levels until next year, and for a few, it is likely to take slightly longer. General Electric Company reported a 16.1% rise in second quarter profit, ending a streak of nine straight quarters of declines, as strong demand for health care and oil and gas equipment boosted results. Net earnings attributable to common shareholders came to $3.03 billion, up from $2.61 billion a year earlier. And Bank of America today says its second quarter net income rose 15% to $2.78 billion as improvements in the company's consumer loan businesses made up for a drop in trading revenue. Bank of America earned 20 cents per share during the April-June period after paying preferred dividends. It earned 33 cents per share a year ago. And that's a look at today's business news. Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Coming up next, corn and soybean futures are not the only commodities Illinois producers keep an eye on. Yes, there's wheat and hogs and even cattle. But Lisa Brotz tells us about at least one other important commodity in her latest edition of In My Backyard.
In some houses, the phrase breakfast of champions means a bowl of cereal. In my house, or more accurately, in my office after I've staggered into work since I can't get it together most mornings to eat before I leave for the day, breakfast of champions often means chocolate. I know, it's so not good for me, but nothing beats the taste of good chocolate with a decent cup of coffee. And truth be told, if I'm eating commodities for breakfast, chocolate's the commodity I'm choosing. Yes, commodities. We hear about them all the time here in the Midwest, since we're a major home to two of the largest, most basic agricultural commodities grown on the planet, corn and soybeans. But really, the term applies to many other agricultural products, including grains like wheat and oats, which are also produced here, and food items that aren't, like sugar, coffee, rice, cacao. That's chocolate to you and me.
Yeah, cocoa is a soft commodity that's traded on mercantile exchanges. I believe it's the smallest exchange. Typically, cocoa is purchased by the shipping container in units of about 20 tons. And cocoa bean sources are kind of blended together so that you're not no longer buying, say, Ivory Coast cacao beans, but just general cocoa beans.
Daniel Schreiber of Flatlander Chocolate, whose production facility, or chocolate factory, is located in East Urbana, is what I would call a micro-producer. He produces food in very small batches for others to eat, and the food he happens to produce is chocolate. But don't call him a chocolatier, which is basically another word for candy maker, for someone who makes things out of chocolate. He doesn't make truffles or turtles or the kind of chocolates you get in a box. He makes the chocolate, the dark, mysterious, fantastic-smelling chocolate that these kinds of chocolates could be made from, and he sells his bars to outlets in Urbana-Champaign and a few other locations in central Illinois. Daniel makes chocolate by taking the process from the bean, the cacao bean, which closely resembles an almond, all the way to the bars he makes and sells, start to finish. This artisanal process, called, well, bean-to-bar, is what makes Flatlander chocolate unique. Flatlander is certainly the only small artisanal bean-to-bar chocolate maker in Illinois and is one of about 10 to 20 in the United States.
Cacao beans are grown on trees between 20 degrees north and south of the equator, primarily in Central and South America and in West Africa. The different countries that we get our beans from vary from Peru, Panama, Madagascar, Ivory Coast. And right now we're ordering the beans through a distributor, but we're working to establish what we call direct trade connections with farmer cooperatives, primarily in Central America.
Here's how artisanal chocolate making works. Daniel starts the process by first cleaning the beans, then roasting them in a convection oven, which gives him some control over the eventual flavor of the chocolate. After roasting, the beans' husks are cracked to get at the cacao inside, the little bits called nibs. Using a home brewer's mill, a shout out to his hobbyist days. Then they're put into a winnower to separate the husks from the nibs. Then the nibs and sugar go into the grinder where the whole mix is ground or refined for 18 to 72 hours. The resulting liquid chocolate is heated and stirred or conched, which is another method to control the flavor of the chocolate. In this case, it's acidity. Anyway, after all this, the chocolate still has to be tempered or alternately heated and cooled for specific periods of time. If extra stuff called inclusions is being added to the chocolate, like salt or caramel or orange peel or dried currants from a local farm, they go in after the chocolate has been poured into molds. Then the chocolate is shaken on a vibrating table to get the air bubbles out of the molds and to settle the inclusions. Later, after cooling, the bars are packaged by hand. I totally adore the packaging of these bars. Instead of foil, the bars are wrapped in unbleached wax paper and then again in colored paper with graphics provided by Daniel's friends for each different kind of bar. You can see the chocolate through the wax paper peeking out at the ends of the bar. It hasn't even been a year since Daniel started out making chocolate at home as a hobby. At first, it was kind of like how people get into the home brewing of beer or the making of wine or the roasting of coffee, things like that. He used equipment cobbled together DIY style to make chocolate for his friends and their friends. He was kind of a chocolate fairy godfather, going around Urbana-Champaign, bestowing his concoctions on the land. Soon enough, though, Daniel decided to press the pause button on his old gig, graduate school in computer science, and do chocolate full-time. Thanks to some fundraising and some benefactors, he's now in business in a former restaurant space in East Urbana. It's a changing neighborhood, and Daniel's hoping that his vision for the space, which goes well beyond making chocolate and into the realm of including community food and garden projects, will get people from the neighborhood and neighboring neighborhoods interested in what he's doing and maybe even directly involved in growing and preparing and eating all kinds of foods, not just chocolate.
I hope that this production facility, with the resources that it provides, especially easily certifiable kitchen space, can serve as a valuable resource for the community, and I hope that it becomes a locus for production of food, for people to pursue their hobbies related to food, to produce food for the farmers market or other venues, and just a valuable community space.
I would expect nothing less from a Breakfast of Champions.
Lisa Brott's stories can also be heard on our website, willang.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com. If you have an idea for an In My Backyard, email us at willagstaff@illinois.edu or call us at 217-333-7300.